senior officials and religious figures from across the Muslim world have delivered speeches ahead of International Quds Day, which is marked by rallies in solidarity with the Palestinian people. The chief commander of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says Israel's national security bubble has burst. Also coming up, Syrian media report an Israeli attack with a helicopter over an area in the country's Honeitra governorate. No damages reported. Welcome to World News. We're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Senior officials and religious figures from across the Muslim world have delivered speeches ahead of International Quds Day, which is marked by rallies in solidarity with the Palestinian people. They hailed the Palestinians' resistance in the face of Israeli occupation and aggression.
Al-Quds is the center of the nation. Everyone should rise. Everyone should say no to the occupiers or to the aggressors, that no one should touch Al-Aqsa or Al-Quds, which is a political capital for the state of Palestine. It is the capital of the faithful heart. Pious hearts, and it also center of conflict and struggle in the heart of the land of Palestine. Despite all the attempts that the Zionist enemy is doing, the attempts of the United States and many countries in the world, the Palestinian people remain in a state of resistance. Today, we see that the liberation of Al-Quds is closer than any day, and today I tell them that our people will remain on this land and will continue to defend this land and protect it with everything that they have, with everything that they own, and you will leave sooner or later because this is our land. This is the land of our fathers and forefathers, and you must go back to where you came from. What we see the free people in Al-Quds facing the Zionist enemy who aims to attack the Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds. They continue with their aggressive policies. This conflict today, this struggle today, this face-off is part of the path towards victory. And you will see how the faithful will come back to the mosque, to the holy sites.
The chief commander of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says Israel's national security bubble has burst. Major General Hossein Salami made the remarks in a TV interview. Salami added that the Zionists are coming closer to a political downfall and their collapse could happen from within. He warned that the first attack on Israel could be the last one, noting that only one operation can destroy the regime. He mentioned some of the recent security failures in Israel, including a cyber attack against 80 Israeli firms, the ammonia gas leak due to an explosion in Haifa, a blast near Ben Gurion Airport, and a rocket attack near Israel's top-secret Dimona nuclear facility. He then warned when 10 incidents happen for Israel, the 11th may possibly follow. Political commentator Bruce Katz says the Israeli regime knows it is not as secure as it hopes.
I think that that there's obviously a good deal of truth to the statement, given the what we've seen over the past little while, the explosion near Dimona, basic blackout or hacking of Israeli firms, which shows that their security net is not quite as secure as they would hope it to be. I think that is a very, very strong statement on the part of General Salami. And basically that the very strong rhetoric coming from Iran is in response to what has been extremely aggressive rhetoric from Israel during the Netanyahu years. And also it's a response to repeated attacks within Syria by Israeli air force that's gone on for a number of years now.
The chairman of the Chiefs of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces says the Palestinian Intifada is more prepared than ever to uproot Israeli occupiers. Major General Mohammed Baqeri warned Israel that the Palestinian uprising has evolved from throwing stones to launching missiles and is on the verge of deterrence. The top Iranian general made the remarks in a Wednesday message to mark the upcoming International Quds Day. That's the last Friday of the holy Muslim month of Ramadan, which was designated by the late founder of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khomeini, in 1979. On the day, people from around the world express support for and solidarity with the Palestinians in the face of Israeli aggression. And Iran's capital, Tehran, has hosted a cartoon exhibition titled Palestine is Not Alone. The event is held to shed light on the suffering of Palestinian people under more than seven decades of Israeli occupation. Yusuf Jalali reports.
From the relocation of the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem al-Quds to the Arab normalization with Israel, these caricatures recount the sufferings of Palestinians under decades of Israeli occupation. Dubbed Palestine is Not Alone, the Tehran-based exhibition showcases artworks submitted by 2,500 artists from over 60 countries.
The exhibition is held online due to the coronavirus pandemic, but in 8 out of the 66 participating countries, the artworks are showcased in physical exhibitions. We have received works from countries as far as Brazil and Colombia, not to mention France, the UK, and many Muslim countries.
The exhibition has a special section that highlights the Arab states' normalization of ties with Israel. Last year, the UAE, Bahrain, and Sudan normalized their ties with Tel Aviv, something which Muslims around the world denounce as betrayal to Palestinians.
Those Arab states that normalized their relations with Israel have long had close ties with the Zionist regime. They only made it public now, but what matters is the fact that the people of those countries reject their government's policies. Muslim and Arab nations do not recognize Israel.
Israel has for seven decades been pressing ahead with construction of illegal settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories and continues to deny millions of Palestinian refugees the right to return. While Palestinians have ever since been resisting the occupation, they believe any kind of support by the world matters. And art is also a powerful medium that can get their messages across.
As we need the bullet, we need the word, we need the poem, we need the culture, we need the arts. Support our cause. Any kind of support for the Palestinian people is benefiting our cause, especially the art. The art is a language that everybody can understand. So such exhibitions will give a good support to our people and will help us, inshallah, in the future to take back our rights from the Zionists.
The expo comes days ahead of the International Quds Day, which falls on the last Friday of the fasting month of Ramadan and is marked annually with rallies. This year, however, the authorities have decided to cancel the rallies due to the coronavirus pandemic. But they say this does not mean that the Palestinian cause is forgotten.
Each one of these cartoons highlights a different side of the Israeli occupation of Palestine, but all boiled down to a single message, and that is, Palestine is not alone. Organizers say, while Israel tries to sweep its crimes under the rug, such events help bring the Palestinian cause to light, and hopefully to an end. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Meanwhile, Israeli forces killed a Palestinian teenager in the northern West Bank city of Nablus. The Palestinian Health Ministry confirmed the death of the 16-year-old who was targeted in the city's Sadr area. According to local sources, two Palestinians were also wounded by Israeli gunfire, one of them critically. Tensions are running high in the occupied West Bank after Israel tightened restrictions on Palestinian worshippers in Jerusalem al-Quds. Since the start of Ramadan, Israeli forces have cracked down on protests against the curbs, leaving dozens of Palestinians injured. Syrian media say Israel has carried out a fresh airstrike on the province of Qunaitra. According to Syrian media, news agencies, no damage or casualties have been reported. We were earlier joined by our correspondent, Muhammad Ali, for an update.
Yes, Syrian state media reported that an Israeli helicopter attacked a position in Al-Quneitra governorate just after midnight local time in Syria without inflicting any damages. Now, we still don't have any official source giving us more details here in Syria, but this is the second Israeli attack on Syria in less than 24 hours. Less than 24 hours ago, there was a wave of Israeli missile attack on various parts of Latakia countryside and, of course, Hama countryside, which killed a civilian and injured six others. We still have to wait and see if we're going to get any more details from an official military source, but definitely this is not a surprise. Israel continues to attack Syria almost every week or two, trying to undermine the Syrian army's capabilities, always striking Syrian army positions and sometimes civilian areas or industrial areas like the attack that happened yesterday. In general, Syria always sends letters to the United Nations calling on the international body to take measures to stop such Israeli attacks and to force Israel to respect the UN Charter and other state sovereignty. But yet, still there is silence from the international community and Israeli strikes continue on Syria.
Now, the Iraqi president has hailed Iran for helping in the fight against terrorism and driving out Daesh militants from the country. In an interview, Barham Saleh also honored Qasem Soleimani, stressing that the Iranian general fought beside Iraqis against terrorism during the difficult times of war. The Iraqi president also praised the bravery of the popular mobilization forces, along with other branches of the Iraqi army, for their significant role in defeating Daesh and terrorism. On the issue of Tehran-Riyadh meetings, Saleh noted that Iraq has so far hosted more than one round of talks between the two sides. The president maintained that a sovereign Iraq is a common interest of the neighboring countries, and Baghdad should be a binding theme for bringing the region together. Damascus has condemned the unilateral sanctions imposed by the U.S. and some Western states on Iran and Syria, calling for their immediate removal. Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Mughdad made the call in a phone conversation with his Iranian counterpart, Mohammad Javad Zarif. Mughdad hailed Tehran's support in the face of unilateral coercive economic measures imposed on the Syrian people. The top Syrian diplomat also accused the U.S. of plundering his people's resources and targeting their livelihoods to undermine their stance on the sovereignty of their country. For his turn, Zarif reiterated Iran's support for Syrians in their battle against terrorism and their fight to determine the future of their country. The two sides also discussed ways of enhancing bilateral relations. Iran has called for urgent and effective measures against what it called unlawful and unjust unilateral sanctions against developing countries. Iran's deputy permanent representative to the United Nations, Zahra Ershadi, said that the nation's right to development would not be exercised with multilateralism, while multilateralism, rather, I should say, is under severe pressure. She added that such bans on science and technology during a global pandemic target ordinary citizens and their right to life and health. Ershadi was speaking at the 6th UN Multi-Stakeholder Forum on Science, Technology and Innovation. Turning elsewhere, Colombian protesters have once again clashed with security forces in Bogota, marking the 8th night of anti-government demonstrations. Demonstrators threw rocks at security forces near a police station, while officers responded by using tear gas to disperse the crowd. The protests, which began against a now-cancelled tax reform plan, have morphed into demonstrations against the government's policies on health, education, security, and violence by police. Demonstrators are calling for universal basic income, the retraction of a health reform plan, and the disbanding of the Mobile Anti-Disturbances Squadron Riot Police. Meanwhile, the Colombian president has called for dialogue to address the ongoing nationwide protests.
El gobierno de Colombia.
I would like to announce that we will create a space in order to listen to the citizens and build solutions orientated toward those purposes.
The UK also noted that the Colombian government does not tolerate violence of any kind. The remarks can come after the United Nations, the European Union and the United States, as well as human rights organizations, criticized the Colombian police for excessive use of force According to official figures, so far at least 19 people have been killed and more than 800 others injured in the ongoing demonstrations. Political commentator Kyla Popichet says the unrest in Colombia was inevitable considering the government's policies, which have not been in favor of the people.
It's quite unfortunate to see what's happening in Colombia, but to be honest, Uribismo, Iván Duque, this was set to come. The neoliberal policies that Colombia's had, its violence against its people for decades, was bound to, you know, the chickens were bound to come home to roost, while the Colombian government has been working with paramilitaries to, one, kill social activists, environmentalists, indigenous leaders in its own country. It's also been working to be a proxy of the U.S. empire in South America against especially its neighbor, Venezuela, whom it has such a close shared history with. It's not surprising to see that the Colombian government and the Colombian police have been acting with brutality and impunity against its people in the streets, because that's what they've been doing covertedly for the past several years. Hundreds and hundreds of social activists and indigenous environmentalists have been murdered. So many ex-FARC members, despite the peace agreement with the Colombian government, have still been murdered by government-backed and U.S.-backed paramilitaries, and the Colombian government does not care. It does not seek to address it. The Colombian government has allowed people to suffer under the pandemic, to die, and to not receive any vaccines, just so that the rich in Colombia can stay richer, so that Uribismo can stay alive. So it's not a surprise to see it, but the chickens have come home to roost, and the Colombian people have been the ones that were reaping the consequences of Colombia being a U.S. proxy state.
Turning to some coronavirus news now, Brazilian officials report over 73,000 new confirmed cases of COVID-19, bringing the country's total closer to 15 million. Brazilian health authorities also registered over 2,800 additional fatalities from the virus. The latest figure has taken the South American nation's death toll to more than 414,000. The country remains the world's second worst hit by the pandemic in terms of fatalities after the United States. This, as the total number of confirmed COVID-19 cases in the U.S. has surpassed 32.5 million. American officials have also so far registered over 579,000 coronavirus deaths. The continued rise in cases and deaths in the U.S. comes despite mass vaccination programs being underway in the country. And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz, every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
India's Prime Minister suffered a rare political defeat in a key state election amid signs of a voter backlash over his handling of the coronavirus disaster, as the country reported a record number of deaths. Narendra Modi, India's Prime Minister, had been expected to make significant gains on Sunday, 2nd of May, in West Bengal, one of few states where his right-wing Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP, does not have a parliamentary majority. Instead, Mamata Banerjee, a powerful regional politician and prominent Modi critic, won a third term as chief minister. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalists Hannah Ellis-Peterson and Luke Harding. The piece is titled, Narendra Modi loses key state election as COVID grips India. India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi has suffered a rare political defeat in a key state election amid signs of a voter backlash over his handling of the coronavirus disaster, as the country reported a record number of deaths. Modi had been expected to make significant gains on Sunday, 2nd of May, in West Bengal, one of few states where his right-wing Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP, does not have a parliamentary majority. Instead, Mamata Banerjee, a powerful regional politician and prominent Narendra Modi critic, won a third term as chief minister in West Bengal. Banerjee's All India Trinamool Congress won a comfortable majority, clocking up 216 seats in the 294-seat assembly. The BJP won 75 seats, up on its performance in 2016 when it got just 3 seats, but well short of predictions. Narendra Modi made dozens of speeches on the campaign trail in West Bengal, together with his Home Minister Amit Shah, who visited as recently as last weekend. Both have been accused of prioritizing politics over the response to the COVID-19 pandemic. On Sunday, 2nd of May, India's new coronavirus cases fell slightly, but there were a record 3,689 new deaths. Grim scenes continue to unfold, with people dying in hospital corridors, on roads, and in their homes. Car parks have been turned into cremation grounds, while desperate families scramble to find medicines and oxygen. Indian authorities reported 392,488 new cases, with the total now at 19.56 million. The coronavirus has killed 215,542 people in India, according to official figures. The actual death toll is estimated to be 2 to 5 times this figure. The United Kingdom has said it will step up its help to the Indian government by providing a further 1,000 ventilators for use in Indian hospitals, although there was no sign it planned to send any more vaccines to India. Up to 10 Indian states and Union territories have imposed some form of restrictions on people's movement. The federal government in India, in New Delhi, however, remains reluctant to impose a national lockdown, citing the damage this will do to India's economy, which shrank dramatically last year. Despite warnings from scientists of a looming second wave of coronavirus infections in India, Narendra Modi addressed large rallies in West Bengal throughout February and March. He refused to wear a face mask, and there was little sign of social distancing. His decision to turn a blind eye to the rising infection rate was fueled by an apparent desperation to win the state. In recent weeks, he took up all the government's attention. The election was the most drawn out in West Bengal's history, conducted in 8 phases over a month. The election commission, in effect controlled by the BJP, refused early requests from opposition political parties to shrink the poll into a shorter period and to make campaigning virtual. In the state capital, Calcutta, the proportion of COVID tests results that are positive has reached 50%, according to some laboratories. Narendra Modi's failure to seize West Bengal can be seen in part as a response to his handling of the coronavirus pandemic. But voters also rejected the BJP's divisive anti-Muslim politics in Bengal, which was the main thrust of its campaign. It is testament, too, to the enduring popularity of Banerjee, India's only female chief minister in power since 2011 and a target of repeated Narendra Modi attacks. The BJP is not an unstoppable force. It can be defeated by a strong-rooted regional leader, the columnist Swati Chaturvedi, wrote on Sunday. The political pendulum is now swinging away from the BJP. The awful central handling of the vicious second wave of COVID-19 and its tragic oxygen shortage will cost Narendra Modi. Vinay Sitapati, an assistant professor of political science at Ashoka University, said, had the BJP won Bengal, it would have spun as validation of their nationwide COVID approach. We should not make the opposition mistake. The Bengal loss is because of a combination of long-standing local factors. He predicted regional leaders and an eventual patchwork of parties rather than a weakened Congress party would now take on Narendra Modi nationally. Votes are being counted in several other Indian states, including Assam, Tamil Nadu, Kerala, and Puducherry. The BJP was on track to keep Assam. In Kerala, the left-wing chief minister, Pinarayi Vijayan, was re-elected, an unprecedented feat for an incumbent. Most of the votes in the state elections were cast in March, but polling in some constituencies continued throughout April, just as India started detecting thousands of fresh coronavirus infections every day. Last Saturday, new cases reached a record daily high of 401,993. Narendra Modi's government has been criticized for letting millions of largely unmasked people attend the religious festivals and crowded political rallies in 5 states throughout the months of March and April. Daily cases in 3 states have surged since then. Over the weekend, Reuters reported that the federal government had been accused of failing to respond to warning from scientific advisers in early March that a new and more contagious COVID-19 variant was taking hold in India.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you because you are
a Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you.
From Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Muslim Lady. It is my absolute honor and pleasure to be with you guys today. And of course, with my wonderful friend and sister, Sister Razia Shamani. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. It's really an honor for me to be here.
So we've been talking about pre-pregnancy steps parents should take in order to have a healthy and close to ideal experience during their pregnancy and for the well-being of themselves and their baby. And we decided to start off with nutritious facts, facts on nutrition, the things that the parents should take. You gave the perfect example of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam and Sayyidah Khadija sallallahu alaiha of 40 days. Well, obviously, these people were purifying themselves throughout their entire life so that they could be the grandparents of that luminous lineage of a'immah, the imams alayhim assalam, right? I mean, it goes back to Nabi Ibrahim even, but specifically for Sayyidah Fatima salamullah alayha, Rasulullah purified himself for 40 days and Allah sent him heavenly fruits to turn into those proteins that would conceive the child. And Sayyidah Khadija salamullah alayha, she was known as Tahira, the pure one, and this and that. So I think with this story, you really highlighted the importance of parents taking care of what they put into their bodies before having a baby. So let's talk more about that if you're cool with it.
Cool. Okay, so about nutrition, we have to know that two points need to be considered. Number one, we need to purify and cleanse the body of the poisons that exist because of our malnutrition or consumption of certain foods.
So toxins, basically. Yeah,
exactly.
Detox ourselves.
Detox our body. And the second factor is to eat and drink healthy food and nutrients. Mm. Okay, so let's start one by one on what to be taken. There is one principle that we have to take into consideration, and that is that if you want healthy children, you will have to have healthy parents.
Duh.
So you can't have like an alcohol addicted a mom or dad. Or you can't have someone who is consuming hashish or other
drugs
and then expect a nice, healthy, smart child.
Sound baby.
Exactly. So this is rule number one. Some people believe that 3 months prior to pregnancy, they will have to detox their bodies of the poisons that exist or of the toxins that exist in the body. And the reason is that the formation, the duration of the formation of the sperm takes 90 days for a new sperm to
be produced.
Exactly. So if you want your body, the conception of your body to be, of your sperm and your eggs to be completely pure, you need to start from 90 days before.
Uh-huh.
That is the reason that you have to start from three-month cycle. And some people believe that because 40, the number 40 is a religious number, they would stick with the 40 number. It's a choice. But if you want to make sure that everything goes well, you can stick with the 90-day period.
Mm. So maybe we could have like a marriage of both. Physically purify themselves for 3 months and spiritually cleanse themselves for 40 days.
That's a very good option.
Good luck, you guys.
Yeah. You know, some people start from the time of the month of Rajab. They start this cycle.
Oh, beautiful.
This decision. Yeah. So if you start cleansing your body and soul from the month of Rajab, where fasting is so highly recommended and has so much heavenly reward, you work on yourself through the 30 days of month of Rajab, and then you go to Shaban, and you get all these blessings, spiritual blessings from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Everything is many, many fold in that month. The spiritual journey is facilitated by the blessings that you will receive. And then the month of Ramadan, which you are, your host is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and the gates of hell are closed, and you have countless opportunities to build yourself physically and spiritually. So that's a very good hint for people who want to start this journey. We have to take into consideration that we have two problems these days. Overeating. We are always constantly, our stomachs are engaged. Our digestion is always engaged, eating this fast food, drinking that, eating that food, eating so many things that we never give any rest to our digestive system. And overeating is actually one of the problems of our age. The second problem is eating food that is not healthy, that it has, you're eating a large mass of food but with very low nutrients. So because of these two points that have become turned into lifestyles, we need to be extra careful in detoxing our bodies.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
One of the problem is that our body naturally gets rid of the toxins through your skin, through the kidneys, through the liver, and through the intestines. But sometimes the mass of all these poisonous and toxins in the body is so much that some is restored in the body and gets into the blood circulation and causes a very sick liver. And when you get this sick liver, there are more toxins stored within your body, which leads to your low immune system. You're always feeling fatigue. You're getting sick, and other problems that having a very bad skin, you know, when your hair starts to fall, and blah, blah, blah. Two things that we eat, that we consume a lot, that harms the liver so much is flour, white flour, and white sugar.
Oh, my God.
All the sweets that we're having every single day. Muffins, donuts, cakes. Exactly. All these lovely food that we always have and we've accustomed ourselves to, these are very poisonous. These they cause a lot of toxins to our body, and storage of these in the
liver.
The fast foods.
That's the saddest piece of information I've received today.
Yeah.
Tragic.
You know, our taste gets used to certain food.
True.
For example, 20 years ago, if you had pizza, you were like, I'll try it. I'm not sure if I like it. And then like, it's not bad. And then, I love it. You know, and now you die for it. But so your taste has changed. I remember first time I tasted cheesecake, I was like, ew.
It's salty and it's weird.
Exactly. It tasted... I exactly remember it was 20 so years ago that I tasted it in a wedding, and it really disgusted me. And then now I'm in love with it.
Exactly.
Why? Because your taste changes over the period of years.
So, and vice versa. Like, children don't like vegetables, they don't like milk and this and that. I look back, but now if I don't have like my vegetables and fibers a day, I feel heavy, and I feel sickly, and I feel ick about myself.
Exactly. When I go to restaurants, I love the sides of the food, which are the vegetables.
Exactly.
More than the meat itself, I would love to go for the sides, the vegetables. So it's a matter of taste, growing and building that taste. I remember when my daughter was small, one of her snacks was bell pepper. She loved bell pepper, like different colors, red, yellow, and green. I would like slice them for them, and she like, even now she loves it. So it really depends on how you build the taste of your child. Okay, getting back to pre-pregnancy and the points we have to take into account. One very good detoxant, according to the Iranian tradition, is the different kinds of ash.
What's that?
Ash is a mixture of sabzis or herbs and certain beans.
Okay. Yeah.
So there are three kinds of ash that are very popular detoxants for pre-pregnancy. I love them. The taste is so good. I remember my grandma used to make a lot of them. Ashajo or barley ash, which you make it, you fry the onions. And then I want this episode to be very practical. We're not giving any theoretical, you know, we've talked enough
idealistic,
about theory.
Right.
Yeah, we want to have some fun programs where you can actually be hands-on and make some food for yourself. And even if you don't want to get pregnant, if you want to have a healthy detoxing cycle, you can do it from now. So you fry the onion and then you add some water, some barley, and some vegetables.
Any vegetables?
Is it
the whole sort of thing where you clear out your fridge and just dump it all in?
No, the taste will get ruined if you add any kinds of vegetables.
Okay, so mindful vegetables.
Yeah, mindful.
Aware.
Yeah. I don't exactly know the kind of vegetable you add inside, but we have to, you know, do a research and see what kind of vegetables. Because in Iran, when you go to the vegetable shop, you say, "I want ash." Vegetables for ash, and they would give it to you. So I
assume it's basically parsley, probably dill. Some people
you know better
spinach.
Than me.
Because my mom, she's a chef, and she's obsessed with these
things.
Wow,
so tell us.
I don't cook,
parsley?
Though. Shout out to people that I don't cook. But, yeah, parsley, maybe dill, spinach. And these are very high in iron, all of it. And what else do they put in? I think they put carrots in it,
if I'm
not mistaken.
No, not in ash.
Joe, barley ash.
That's barley soup you're talking about.
Ah, okay. See, I don't cook.
But the herbs that you mentioned were perfect. So this is one. The other one is aloo bukhara ash. I actually searched aloo bukhara. It's aloo bukhara. Aloo bukhara is actually dried plums. Yeah, so they're very rich in fiber. And one very good detoxing dish for pre-pregnancy is also verjuice ash or ashe apgure.
Okay.
Unripe grape. Where they juice the unripe grape, it's very sour, and it's extra good for lowering the blood pressure. So a lot of people who have high blood pressure, they take one small cup of verjuice
in the morning probably.
And prior to going to bed.
Right. But women should be careful though of consuming it too much.
Exactly.
Because as far as I know, most women have low blood pressure.
Yeah. And for people with ulcers, consuming vinegar and a lot of verjuice is not good at all.
Yes.
So they have to be replaced with some other stuff. These were just three dishes that are used for detoxing the body pre-pregnancy. That usually women consume it, but also men, they can use it, as we said, you know, the cycle.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Now I'm hungry.
Thank
Congratulations. Thank you so much, ladies and gentlemen, for being with us on this episode of Muslim Lady, where we talked about pre-pregnancy steps to detox our bodies and make it ready for the baby. Until another episode, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Who is the Lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. To Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah, Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Biden administration's weapons sales to the UAE is a disastrous move. It puts the U.S. squarely on the side of a serial human rights abuser and inflames a region already awash with way too many weapons. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Media Benjamin and Ariel Gold, anti-war activists. This article is published under the heading, Why is Biden selling weapons to a country that helped make Yemen a hell hole? Stay tuned for more. The Biden administration's recent announcement giving a green light to a massive $23 billion weapons sales to the United Arab Emirates makes a mockery of its commitment to put human rights at the forefront of its foreign policy. the Emirates' disastrous roles in Yemen and Libya, along with its vicious human rights record at home, should disqualify it from acquiring advanced weapons. The deal was negotiated under the Trump administration and came to light less than a week after Donald Trump announced the normalization of relations between the Zionist regime and the UAE, known as the Abraham Accords. While the public was diverted with Trump's supposedly brilliant peace initiative, the secret clause that sweetened the deal was leaked. The U.S. would sell billions of dollars of weapons to the Persian Gulf state, 50 F-35 fighter jets, 18 Reaper drones, and various missiles, bombs, and munitions. The UAE and the Zionist regime have never been at war and had maintained unofficial ties for years, but the peace accord allowed the Trump administration to circumvent a policy that requires the United States to guarantee the Israeli regime's military superiority in the region. The Zionist regime's Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu initially feigned outrage that another West Asian country besides the regime would possess the high-tech F-35, but it was soon revealed that the Prime Minister had been in the know from the start and had approved the deal with his own caveat. The Israeli regime would get additional U.S. weapons to balance those going to the UAE. Congressional opponents of the arms deal responded by introducing a bipartisan resolution of disapproval to block the sale. Surprisingly, hawkish Senator Bob Menendez, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, led the resolution with Senators Chris Murphy and Ron Paul. They cited concerns about the timing as a rushed end run around Congress, the UAE's troubling involvement in Yemen and Libya. Though their legislation was voted down when Joe Biden came into office, the State Department put this sale, as well as a weapons deal Trump had negotiated with Saudi Arabia, on hold. Human rights groups were encouraged that the Biden review might lead to a quashing of the deal, but apparently, geopolitical pressures, the hawks in the administration, and pressure from the weapons lobby have won the day. The companies that stand to gain hefty profits from this sale include Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, General Atomics, and Northrop Grumman. Lockheed Martin will get $10.4 billion selling 50 of its F-35s. According to the New York Times, Raytheon, the biggest supplier of the bombs, lobbied the Trump administration for the deal. Trump's Secretary of Defense Mike Esper was a lobbyist for Raytheon, and Biden's Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin is a former Raytheon board member. The UAE's role in Yemen should have been enough to quash the deal. For the past 6 years, the U.S.-supported coalition led by Saudi Arabia has been waging a war in Yemen so brutal that, according to David Beasley, executive director of the World Food Program, this war-torn nation is hell on earth, where one Yemeni child dies every 75 seconds. In 2017, Human Rights Watch and Associated Press accused the UAE of operating secret prisons in Yemen where prisoners were subjected to horrific forms of torture. Former inmates described cramped conditions covered in feces, being beaten, sexually assaulted, and trussed up on a grill. "We could hear the screams," said a former detainee held for 6 months at the Ryan Airport. "The entire place is gripped by fear. Almost everyone is sick. The rest are near death. Anyone who complains heads directly to the torture chamber," said one former detainee. In addition to its direct involvement, the UAE supported local proxies, around 90,000 fighters, providing them with direct training, capacity building, logistic assistance, and salaries. It also brought in mercenaries from as far away as Colombia, and weapons sold to the UAE ended up in the hands of Al-Qaeda terrorists inside Yemen. Complaints have been filed in the courts in the UK and the US alleging that UAE mercenaries in Yemen committed human rights abuses and war crimes. They also allege that the UAE joined the Saudis in enforcing a naval blockade that has kept fuel, food, and medicines from people in need, committing over 30 fighter jets to carry out airstrikes and naval ships to enforce the coalition's blockade. Anxious to get out of a losing war that has been so bad for its image, the Emirates held a ceremony on February 9, 2020, to mark the end of their involvement in the Yemeni war, moving from a military-first strategy to a peace-first strategy. But humanitarian groups on the ground tell us that the UAE maintains a presence in Saqqarah, Mokalla, and a small presence in Yemen. In addition, it offers financial and military support to a variety of armed groups and political movements that have had a destabilizing influence throughout the country, particularly in the south. Another strike against the Saudis is that it is fueling the West Asia arms race. While the UAE is set to become the first Arab state to acquire F-35s, it will not be the last. Qatar has already asked to purchase them, and Saudi Arabia will likely follow. The Israeli regime is expecting additional arms beyond the $3.8 billion they already receive annually from the U.S. in military assistance. A final reason is to oppose the deal is the UAE domestic situation. Prince Mohammed bin Zayed is a shrewd West Asian dictator who uses his country's military and financial resources to thwart moves toward democracy and respect for human rights under the guise of fighting terrorism. The UAE restricts freedom of expression and silences dissent. According to Amnesty International, in 2020, despite the COVID-19 pandemic, the UAE continued to detain dozens of prisoners of conscience, including prominent human rights defender Ahmed Mansour. The government keeps opponents under arbitrary detention, and a number of prisoners remain incarcerated despite having completed their sentences. On April 15, 2021, a cross-party coalition of European parliamentarians condemned the systematic crackdown on freedom of speech and expression and called for the release of all prisoners of conscience and an end to torture and ill treatment of these prisoners and the protection of prisoners' families from collective punishment. Another group subject to all kinds of abuses are the millions of migrants who work in Emirates under the kafala system, a type of visa sponsorship system which deprives workers of basic rights. Faced with domestic crises that include a pandemic, a battered economy, and exploding racial tensions, President Biden understands the need to focus his attention on domestic issues and win down U.S. military entanglements from the past two decades. His recent announcement that U.S. troops will leave Afghanistan by September 11, 2021 reflects this. A $23 billion weapon sales to the UAE is a disastrous move in the Biden administration. It puts the U.S. squarely on the side of a serial human rights abuser and inflames a region already awash with way too many weapons. A new round of legislation by Senators Menendez and Feinstein is being introduced to put checks on the sale of F-35s, but it is the entire sale that must be questioned. If Biden refuses to put domestic and human rights concerns ahead of the profits of weapons manufacturers, then Congress must step and pass legislation to stop it.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English